Chapter 35. The first piece of good news Cabrillo had heard in a while was that he was familiar with the supertanker slowly overtaking the Libyan frigate. She was the Petromax Oil ULCC Aggie Johnston, and several months earlier the Oregon had saved her from being hit by a couple of Iranian torpedoes by firing one of their own at the sub that had launched them. They were close enough now that he had to assume all communications could be monitored by the Gulf of Sidra. To get around that, he found the ship's email address on the Petromax website and sent its captain a note. It was far from convenient, and their exchanges went back and forth for nearly 10 minutes before he could convince the captain that he was the commander of the freighter now shadowing them from 1,000 yards away and not some lunatic kid emailing from his parents' basement in any town, USA. As Juan waited for each reply, he lamented that Mark and Eric weren't aboard. Those two could have hacked the parent company's mainframe to issue the orders directly, and he wouldn't have to explain what he wanted from the floating behemoth and why. A fresh email appeared in his inbox. "Captain Cabrillo, it goes against my better instincts and my years of training, but I will agree to do what you've asked, provided we don't come within a half mile of that frigate, and you provide the same sort of protection you did in the Straits of Hormuz if they fire on us. As much as I want to do more, I must place the well-being of my ship and crew above my desire to help you unreservedly. I've spent the better part of my career operating out of Middle Eastern ports, and hate what these terrorists have done to the region, but I can't allow anything to happen to my vessel. And as you can well imagine, if we were loaded with oil rather than running in ballast, the answer would have been an unequivocal no. All the best, James McCullough. P.S. Give him one on the chin for me. Good hunting." "Hot damn," Juan cried. "He'll do it." Max Hanley was standing across the pilot house chart table, the stem of his pipe clamped between his tobacco-stained teeth. "I wouldn't get that excited when you're contemplating playing chicken with a fully armed frigate." "This will be perfect," Juan countered. "We'll be inside his defenses before they know what we're up to. We worked the vectors as we narrowed the gap and kept the tanker between us and the Sidra the whole time. As far as they know, there's only the one ship that's going to pass them. They have no idea we're here and won't until the Johnston breaks off." He typed a reply on a wireless-connected laptop as he spoke. "Captain McCullough, you are the key to saving the Secretary's life, and I can't thank you or your crew enough. I only wish that afterward you'd receive the accolades you so richly deserve, but this incident must remain secret. We will flash your bridge with our Aldous lamp when we want you to begin. That should be in about 10 minutes. Again, my sincerest thanks, Juan Cabrillo." Spread across the table was a detailed schematic of the Russian-built Kony-class frigate, showing all her interior passages. Also, there were Mike Trono and Jerry Pulaski, who would be leading the assault teams. They were well-trained fire-eaters who'd seen more than their share of combat, but Juan wished Eddie Seng and Franklin Lincoln would be in on the attack with him. Behind Trono and Pulaski were the 10 other men who would be boarding the Libyan ship. Outside the starboard windows lurked the 1,000-foot slab of steel that was the Aggie Johnston's hull. With the Oregon ballasted down to lower her profile and the supertanker nearly empty, the Johnston seemed to loom over them even at this distance. The accommodation block at her stern was the size of an office building, and her squat funnel resembled an upended railroad tank car. "Okay, back to this. Do we all agree the most likely place for the execution is the crew's mess?" "It's the biggest open space on the ship," Mike Trono said. He was a slender man with fine brown hair who'd come to the corporation after working as a pararescue jumper. "Makes sense to me," Ski remarked. The big pole was a former Marine who towered half a head over the others. Rather than wear combat clothing, the men had donned sailors' uniforms that Kevin Nixon's staff had modified to resemble the utilities worn by Libyan sailors. An instant of confusion on an opponent's part on seeing a familiar uniform but an unfamiliar face could mean the difference between life and death.
"Why a ship?" Mike asked suddenly.
"Sorry?"
"Why carry out the execution on a ship?"
"It'll be next to impossible to triangulate where the broadcast signal originates," Max replied. "And even if you can, the vessel's long gone by the time anyone comes out to investigate."
"We're going to enter the Sidra here," Juan said, pointing to an amidships hatch on the main deck. "We then move two doors down on the right to the first staircase. We take it down one flight, then it's left, right, left. The mess will be right in front of us."
"There's gonna be a lot of sailors in there to watch," Jerry predicted.
"I'd agree normally," Juan said, "but as soon as we make our move, they'll go to general quarters. The hallways will be deserted, and anyone left in the mess is going to be a terrorist. The legitimate crew will be at their battle stations. We take out the Tangos, grab Miss Katamura, and get off that tub before they know we were even there."
"There's still one problem with your plan," Max said, relighting his pipe. "You haven't explained our exit strategy. As soon as we pull away, Sidra's going to nail us. I've been thinking about it, and I want to suggest that another team board her, carrying satchel charges. The Oregon can disable some of her armaments during the attack, and they can blow up what gets missed."
Hanley wasn't known for his tactical insights, so Juan was genuinely impressed.
"Why, Max, what a well-reasoned and carefully considered plan."
"I thought so, too," he preened.
"Only thing is, those men would get cut down long before they could approach the Sidra's primary weapon systems."
Juan pointed to the schematic again. "They've got emplacements for 30-caliber machine guns on all four corners of the superstructure. We can knock out the ones we can see, but the two on the far side are protected by the ship itself. Our boys would be cut to ribbons."
"Send Gomez up in the chopper and hit them with a missile," Hanley said, defensive that his plan was being questioned.
"SAM coverage is too tight. He'd never get close enough."
Max looked crestfallen, and his voice was a little sulky when he asked,
"All right, smart guy, what's your idea?"
Juan peeled back the naval drawings. Beneath them was a chart of the Libyan coastline due south of their current position. Juan tapped his finger on a spot 10 miles west of them.
"This."
Max looked from Juan down to where he pointed and back up again. His smile was positively demonic.
"Brilliant.
Thought you'd like that. It's the reason we're delaying the attack for a few minutes. We need them close enough for this to work."
Cabrillo added, "If there isn't anything else, we should all get into position."
"Let's do this," Mike Trono said.
The men descended the outside stairs to get to the main deck. Juan and Max lingered a moment.
"You still look a bit peevish," Cabrillo said to his best friend.
"You're going into the lion's den, Juan. This isn't like when we sneak into some warehouse in the middle of the night by knocking out a couple of rent-a-cops. There are some real bad apples on that ship, and I'm afraid as soon as they realize something's up, they're going to kill her straight away, and this'll all be for nothing."
A glib reply died on the chairman's lips. He said somberly,
"I know, but if we don't try, they've already won. In a way, this war started in these waters 200 years ago. We as a nation stood up back then for our core principles and said enough is enough. Wouldn't it be something if we ended here too, fighting for the very same things?"
"If nothing more, it would be rather poetic justice."
Juan slapped him on the back, grinning.
"That's the spirit. Now get down to the op center, and don't hurt my ship when I'm gone."
Max shook his head like an old bloodhound.
"That's one promise you know I can't keep."
Once they gave Captain McCullough the signal, the massive tanker altered her course southward toward the Libyan frigate. It was done subtly and without warning, but inexorably the distance between the two vessels shrank. On her original course,
The Aggie Johnston would have passed the Sidra with a 5-mile separation, but as the trailing distance closed, so too did the range. Staying tight to her flank, the Oregon II closed in on its prey. The radios stayed quiet until the tanker was a mile astern and 2 miles north of the frigate. Juan had a portable handset as he waited in the shadow of the gunwales with his men. With the sun beginning to set behind them, the worst of the day's heat had abated, and yet the deck was still too hot to touch comfortably.
"Tanker approaching on my stern. This is the Khalij Cert of the Libyan Navy. You are straying too close for safe passage. Please alter your course and increase your separation before coming abeam."
"Khalij Cert, this is James McCullough of ULCC Aggie Johnston." McCullough had a smooth, cultured voice. Juan pictured him standing around 6'2", and, for some reason, bald as an egg.
"We are experiencing a rogue ebb tide right now. I have the rudder over, and she's starting to respond. We will comply with your directive in time, I assure you."
"Very good," came the curt reply from the Sidra. "Please advise if you continue to have difficulties."
McCullough had stuck to Juan's script, and the first act of the play had gone perfectly. Of course, the tanker's captain would maintain his heading and, in the process, buy the Oregon more time. 10 minutes went by, and the speeds of the ships relative to each other had narrowed the gap by another 30 miles. Juan thought the Libyans would have called much earlier. He considered it a good omen that there didn't seem to be any alarm.
"Aggie Johnston, Aggie Johnston, this is the Khalij Cert."
The man's tone was still cool and professional.
"Are you still experiencing difficulties?"
"A moment, please," McCullough radioed back as if pressed for time. When he didn't respond for 2 minutes, the Libyans repeated their request, this time a bit more forcefully.
"Yes, sorry about that. The ebb intensified. We're coming out of it now."
"We did not experience this tidal action you seem to be facing."
"That's because our keel is 40 feet down and stretches for 3 football fields.
"Easy, Jimmy boy," Juan thought.
Juan and the captain had worked it out, so the next call originated from McCullough. 2 minutes after the last comment, he was on the horn again.
"Khalij Cert, this is the Aggie Johnston. Please be advised our steering gear just failed. I have ordered an emergency stop, but at our current speed, it will take us several miles. I calculate I will pass down your port beam with a 30-mile clearance. May I suggest you alter your speed and heading?"
Rather than slowing, the tanker began a steady acceleration, her single prop churning the water into a maelstrom at her fantail. This wasn't in the script, and Juan knew that McCullough was ignoring his own preset conditions in order to get the Oregon in as tight as he possibly could. Cabrillo vowed to find the man and buy him a drink when this was over. The Sidra had begun to turn away and gain speed, but she was still going slow enough that her maneuvers were sluggish. The tanker dwarfed the warship as she started to cruise past, moving at 18 knots, only a third of a mile off the Libyan's rail. Juan felt the Oregon's deck shiver ever so slightly. Her big pumps were rapidly draining seawater from her saddle ballast tanks. They were going in. In the op center, Max Hanley sat at the fore helm. Like Juan, he'd listened to the entire exchange, but unlike the chairman, he'd been able to at least watch some of the action. Next to him was the weapons tech. Every exterior door was folded back and every gun run out. The ship literally bristled. He killed power to the pump jets, then reversed the flow. Water exploded in a churning wave from the bow tubes, and the ship slowed so quickly her stern lifted slightly out of the water. As soon as she was clear of the Aggie Johnston, he cut reverse and applied forward pressure through the tubes. The cryo pumps keeping the magnetohydrodynamics chilled to 100 degrees below zero began to sing as the jets demanded more and more energy. The Oregon accelerated like a racehorse, carving a graceful curve around the back of the tanker. In front of him was the low gray silhouette of the Libyan frigate. He could imagine the consternation on the Sidra's bridge when a ship twice its size suddenly appeared without warning from around the supertanker. After what had to have been a stunned 30 seconds, the airways came alive with expletives, demands, and threats. Max nimbly tucked the Oregon between the two vessels, even as McCullough turned sharply northward to gain sea room and safety.
"Identify yourself, or we will open fire."
That was the second time Max had heard the challenge, and he doubted there would be a third. There was still a big enough gap for the Sidra to rake the Oregon with her 3-inch cannons. He resisted the strong impulse to snatch up the handset and identify themselves as the USS Siren. Watching on the monitor, he saw a cloud like a big cotton ball bloom in front of the Sidra's forward gun. The shell shrieked by the bow and exploded in the sea 50 feet off her beam an instant before the concussion of the shot rumbled across the Oregon. "Warning shots free, my friend," Max said tightly. "Next one, and the gloves come off." The rear gun discharged this time, and an explosive shell slammed into the wing bridge, blowing it completely away. Max could barely keep himself in his chair.
"That's it. Fire at will."
The narrowing gulf between the two combatants came alive as the Oregon's 30-millimeter Gatling guns and bigger Beaufort's autocannon spewed out continuous streams of fire. The Sidra's own anti-aircraft guns added to the thunder of her main batteries, which were firing at a 4-shot-a-minute clip. The Oregon rang like a bell with each staggering impact. The rounds from the AAA penetrated her hull, but were stopped by the next bulkhead. The deck gun's rounds burst through. Already 3 cabins were in ruins, and slabs of marble had been ripped from the walls of the ballast tank that doubled as a swimming pool. Every impact saw more destruction. The boardroom where the senior staff met took a direct hit. The 500-pound table was upended, and the leather chairs turned to kindling. The automated fire suppression system was battling a 6 simultaneous blazes. Fire teams had been told to stay on the opposite side of the ship with the rest of the crew rather than risk themselves during the duel. But the Oregon was giving as good as she got. All the Sidra's bridge windows had been shot out, and enough tungsten rounds poured through the openings to mangle all the navigation and steering equipment. Rounds sparked off her armored hide. Her lifeboat shook like a rat in the jaws of a terrier when the Gatling hosed it. When it moved on, the craft was riddled with holes and hung drunkenly from one set of pulleys. None of their smaller caliber weapons could penetrate the armor protecting the turrets, so the weapons officer loosened the bow-mounted 120-millimeter cannon. Because it used the same stability control system as an M1A2 main battle tank, this main gun had unbelievable accuracy. Its first round hit where the turret met the Sidra's deck, and the entire mass jumped 5 feet into the air before smashing back again, greasy smoke billowing from the gun's barrel. The two ships continued to pound on each other, each capable of absorbing tremendous punishment, as the gap grew narrower still. At point-blank range, there was no need to aim. Rounds impacted almost the instant they left the guns. Nothing like this had been seen in the annals of naval warfare for a century, and despite the danger, Max Hanley wouldn't have wanted to be anyplace else in the world. Not so for the chairman and the men on deck. They were hunkered behind a section of rail that had been triple reinforced, but when a 30-millimeter autocannon raked the bulwark, they all felt naked and exposed. Juan couldn't imagine fighting this way as a normal course of events. Technology had sanitized warfare, made it cold and distant. The press of a button was all that was needed to vanquish your enemy. This was something else entirely. He could feel their hatred. It was as if each shot they took was an expression of personal loathing. They wanted him dead, and not just dead, but blown out of existence, as if he had never been born at all. Another shell slammed into the armor plate, and for a moment it felt to Juan like his insides had liquefied. For a terrifying moment, he thought he had made a huge mistake. Then he thought, no. These people would not stop until someone stood up to them. If they wouldn't listen to reason, they would have to face the consequences of their own barbarity. There came a brutal shudder. The Oregon was alongside the Sidra. Max had known to ballast their ship so the two railings were even. Juan snatched up his compact machine pistol and threw himself over the side. The shimmering trail of an RPG launched from a concealed redoubt astern of the Sidra's rear turret passed inches over his head and hit the armored plate just as the rest of his 12-man team was following. The hit couldn't have been luckier or worse. 10 of the men were blown back by the blast, bloodied and suffering concussions, and 2 were tossed forward just as a wave separated the ship slightly. They plummeted down into the tight space and hit the water simultaneously. Max had seen the disaster on the closed-circuit television system and immediately hauled the Oregon away from the Sidra so the hulls wouldn't slam together and smear the men into paste. He didn't know if they were alive or dead, but he ordered the rescue team standing by in the boat garage to immediately launch a Zodiac. A tech moved a joystick to swivel the camera and scan the Sidra's deck.
"There!" Max shouted.
Cabrillo stood alone on the Libyan ship, his Heckler and Koch machine pistol smoking after taking out the gunman who was reloading his rocket launcher. It was almost as if he knew the camera was on him. He looked directly at it with the most savage expression Max had ever seen, and then vanished alone through the frigate's hatchway.